Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Bull Time Investor. My name is Adam Johnston and I am joined today by Scott Hartman.
Hey, Adam.
And we also have Corey Marlowe, who is feeling a little under the weather, but he is here in spirit and recording with us. Scott, I'm going to go ahead and throw it over to you and ask you to introduce the guest speaker that we have on today.
Yeah, today we have Kevin Simpson with us. He's the founder and CEO of Capital Wealth Planning, based out of Naples, Florida. Hopefully it's a little bit warmer than we are here today with a negative 30 wind chill, but I don't think it's too warm right now. But CWP is a SEC investment advisory firm. Currently, they're managing about $10 billion of assets under management. And they do just a really good job with blue chip stock portfolios. So yeah, that's Kevin specifically told me not to go too in depth there, so we will we'll go from here. So, Kevin, can you tell us a little bit about your journey into the world of finance and what inspired you to start Capital Wealth Planning?
Yeah, Scott, Adam, thank you both for having me on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Again, I know we're going to miss Corey, but it'll be the three of us will get more of a chance to speak because he always hogs the mic. So
for sure.
I appreciate the question. You know, I was incredibly interested in the stock market beginning in and around 1987. We had a crash in October of 87, at which point I was still in school, but I was just so curious about what had happened and why that from that moment on, there was pretty much nothing else that I saw myself doing outside of running money. And I've been, professionally managing money for 32, 33 years now. And it's a wonderful experience because every day is a challenge. Every day is a new exploration and current events, and you can never kind of sit back and put anything on autopilot because the second you kind of think that you know what's coming, you're proven wrong. So I'm drawn to the financial world because of that academic challenge and the fact that it's a never ending journey.
Awesome. That, kind of leads right into the next. So what lessons, I guess, from that early career when you experienced that crash in October of 87, what lessons have you have shaped you from that and into your investment philosophies today?
I was blessed to have incredibly stern mentors who would keep me incredibly humble and grounded. And I say that because when I got into the business, the first 7 years, like literally 7 years in a row, stock market moved higher. And it's easy to have some hubris and ego and think that things are really easy when that's the case. But they would intellectually remind me constantly that this is not something that happens forever. And when markets are green and moving higher, it's reason to be happy and excited, but never to expect it to continue. And it was always about hedging, you know, trying to avoid the large losses and making sure that we were able to participate in markets that were in bull runs. And the lessons and the grounding were extremely important because if you think back to my early career, and this is circa 92 into 99, where that stock market had that nice run, certainly thereafter in the very early part of 2000, it was a much, much different story. And it continued to be into the 08, 09 great financial crash. And then ultimately when the COVID crisis hit in 2020, I had enough experience under my belt that even though I didn't know what a coronavirus was or a global pandemic, I knew very clearly how the market was trading because I had been through it so many times before. So maybe it's not just being smart, maybe it's being old, but it was an incredible tutelage that I had with really, really smart people who took an incredible amount of time to teach me the world of money management.
Walk me through that year eight, right? Your first 7 years are great. Market's going up, up, up. Everything feels great. That eighth year hits. I mean, what kind of adjustments did you see yourself having to make?
This was the breaking of the dot-com bubble in early 2000. So it was something that didn't affect me as much, but neither did the big run-up. I remember the first day that I started, my mentor was like, probably think you know a lot. Studied this in college and followed it, probably trade your own account. But trust me, you don't know anything and everything you've learned is wrong. So this is a a day one clean slate. So for those 7 years, I was pretty much berated on, if not a daily basis, almost nearly there. So, but the way we invested is the same way we do now. It's built on fundamental companies, profitable businesses that pay dividends. And it's old fashioned for sure, but it avoided the massive run-up in that dot-com bubble. There were magazine covers that were declaring the death of Warren Buffett's style box at that time. And there was a client that fired me in 1998, mentioning in great, you know, specific detail that she wouldn't refer me to her worst enemy. This was like a sweet old lady. I was like, well, that's pretty harsh. And the reason for that was I invested in her. I made an investment in a company called Merck Pharmaceuticals, MRK, which we still own today, you know, some 30 years later almost. But the point of the story is Merck wasn't a dot-com bubble stock. Merck wasn't a stock that was doubling every day like so many of these other non-profitable businesses. And her next-door neighbor in Princeton, New Jersey, worked for Lucent Technologies, which was the old Bell Laboratories. She wanted that. And I was like, yeah. Well, I don't think that we're going to invest in that because I'm not really understanding the profitability of this company. And so many people didn't care about profitability. You know, you have animal spirits and markets are moving and everything's going up that has to do with the internet. So we missed the upside in large part. But fortunately, we were able to miss the explosion.
You know, it's interesting you bring up that story on Merck. I've been reading a lot and talking a lot about the FOMO or the fear of missing out in investments today. And it seems like, you know, going back to that story, there was a lot of individuals who had that same fear of missing out back in the late 90s when you're talking about the tech run-up.
History doesn't always repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And I think when you look at the Magnificent Seven, the AI trades here over the past 2 years, there's incredible similarities. One distinct difference is that there are real businesses here behind the artificial intelligence euphoria. These are companies that have profits and make money and have earnings. In the late 90s, so many of these companies were just pure speculation, you know, without any prospects of ever seeing a nickel in revenue. And the human nature is always the same. I want to participating in things that are moving higher, and it's very hard to separate emotion and mathematics when it comes to investing. So I have to, as a portfolio manager in a large cap blue chip portfolio, as I was trained to do from day one, is to look at our portfolio and say, we're probably never going to make the most money to the upside, probably never going to have the high flying growth stocks, and people will always pay up for innovation. So it's going to be tough to compete when there's fire under a market. But if we can make sure that we avoid the big losses, then it becomes more the tortoise and the hare, where if things revert to the mean over time, we want to look more like the tortoise than the hare. And the nice thing about your role as advisors is that you can partner and pair, bring money managers in that can accomplish different goals based on clients' risk tolerances. And so often we see our little bit more steady Eddie portfolio partnered or paired with a more high octane growth strategy. That way, when you have years like 2022 or 2000 or 2008, when things go a little bit haywire, you've got something else that, although our stocks might be down, you know, rising tides can lift all ships, but it can work in the opposite direction as well. But if we can be down slightly, we're able to live and intellectually fight another day. So it's a question and a balancing act that is difficult for us as portfolio managers sometimes, because, you know, we can look at some of these stocks and think, boy, what a run. But at the same time, we're always managing things with an eye on risk more than anything else. And that gives you the ability to balance different style boxes, strategists, and strategies for your clients and make changes as appropriate based on, you know, how things perform.
Kevin, can you elaborate just a little bit about like the covered call strategy that you've developed and how that, you know, kind of benefits our clients?
Yeah, my strategy is really a company, an accumulation of companies that have great revenue streams, mature companies. When you get a a portfolio printout from you guys with one of our portfolios, your clients are going to see everything they own. They're going to know everything they own. And although familiarity isn't a reason always to buy a stock, it's comforting when you've got volatility or down markets. So we'll typically have 25 to 30 names in the portfolio across all sectors, which is important because even if tech's hot, we're not going to put all of our money in tech and increase our risk profile. We're not market timers. We're not smart enough to do that. So we try to be diversified investors in great businesses that all pay dividends. And what we think the portfolio will develop moving forward is strong dividend growth. And over the past 12, 13 years, our dividends have increased at about a 9% clip every year, which is powerful. You know, if you're getting a 9% raise, that's really the inflationary hedge, whether inflation's at 9% like it was during the pandemic, or whether it goes back to the Fed's 2% level. We believe that companies that are increasing their dividends because they're increasing their earnings revenues will be good total return investments over time. And then also recognizing that stocks don't always go up, that sometimes they go down. We utilize covered call writing as a means of harvesting volatility to smooth out the ride a little bit and to modestly protect the downside when stocks are down. Byproduct of the covered calls and the tactical way in which we use them will generate additional cash flow. So if you look at the dividends with a 2 to 3% projected yield, we try to get 2 to 3% from dividends. The option premiums, depending upon market volatility, can generate another 2, 3, maybe as much as 4% a year. And when you combine those, we try to imagine generating a cash flow that's going to be somewhere between 4, 5, 6%. And on average, for the past, again, 12, 13 years, it's averaged around 5. And that's important because whether markets are up, down, or sideways, if you're collecting dividends, you have the ability to have some option premium, provides an income stream if you're taking income. And if not, you know, then it's even better because you've got that incredible thing called the power of compounding, which in my opinion is the true means of wealth creation over time.
Awesome. Can we jump to the your take on the current state of financial markets? Kevin, what are some of the sectors or trends investors should pay attention to, and maybe some that we should look to avoid in 2025 and beyond?
I mean, I think people always pay up for innovation. So as good as the tech names have done for the past 2 years, there's still companies that are generating the most growth within the S&P 500. Now, I won't allocate more than 25% to any one sector. So inherently, I'm always going to be a little bit light tech. I also won't invest more than 5% in any one company because as good as something might be, they're good until they aren't. And I want to make sure I'm managing my risk profile. I really like financials, also a sector similar to technology that did really well last year. But relatively speaking, the margins are very, very profitable. Their valuations are not high, even by historical standards. And they have tremendous commitment to shareholders through buybacks, dividends. And if you believe that there's a merger and acquisition opportunity, a window for IPOs to reopen, a new pro-growth administration, then those sectors should continue to benefit. Pharmaceuticals have been under tremendous pressure. They may continue to be. So you kind of think about where you can be excited and where you might not expect the greatest returns. I still think technology and financials should do well. We talk about energy being a beneficiary of this new administration also, and maybe pharmaceuticals lagging a little bit as you sort through whatever regulation is on the horizon.
You'd mentioned the Magnificent Seven earlier. Do you see the S&P widening out a little bit to where the other 493 kind of catch up to that seven this year?
I sure hope so. I really don't invest in the Magnificent Seven. I stick with the more broader markets. But yeah, I think that the expectations for earnings this year are still strong and solid within the big tech, and they need to carry it. But there's a slowdown in those massive high growth numbers that we saw, almost explosive. And we are seeing good numbers and expectations for those other 490 or 93, depending upon where you consider your magnificent number. But the expectations for S&P earnings is high, almost double what they typically are for 2025. And they need to deliver because markets have come a long way. And for markets to move higher, it's based on earnings and multiples, and the multiples are going to be stretched no matter what your how you look at valuations. They're at the higher end of the spectrum. There's no need to debate semantics, whether it's the equal weight or the traditional S&P 500. They're a little bit high. So earnings need to deliver, and I expect that they can. If they don't, then this is going to be a much, much more difficult for the market this year. But even with the better than expected earnings, and even if they come to fruition, you don't usually get 20%, 20%, 20%. You don't get those three big years in a row, although I did at the beginning of my career, but it doesn't happen often. And markets can still move higher after 20% back-to-back years. It just might be a little bit more tempered. So that would be my expectation. Still a good year with some volatility along the way, which we haven't seen much of in the past 2 years, and maybe just a more muted return.
Awesome. Here's kind of a question. If you had one piece of financial advice you could give to people getting ready to retire, something like that, what advice would you give them?
Well, there's different pieces of advice that you give people along their financial journey. So the advice that you give someone who's a baby boomer like me approaching retirement is a lot different than you give my son, who's engaging in a career and starting to invest. And the thing that I always try to instill with investors that have lots of money is we don't necessarily need to take as much risk as we did when we were younger. In large part, we don't want to have to rebuild it. We don't want to suffer the massive loss that requires the rebuild, so to speak. And granted, when you de-risk, you forfeit a little bit of that upside when things are working. But if you can have a strong equity exposure with more higher quality names, you reduce your volatility, still make a lot of money. But the biggest thing as you approach retirement is recognizing that de-risking probably makes a whole lot of sense. And you have a lot of money. You still want to earn it. You still want it to do well. But you don't want to have to give it back. That's not always easy to do because it's fun going to a cocktail party and talking about how much NVIDIA you have. Not for me, because I don't have any. But sure. For everybody else.
So, as you see the markets evolving, active management evolving, in a world increasingly dominated by. Sorry, cut that, Brody. So how do you see the role of active management evolving in a world increasingly dominated by passive investing?
I'm biased because I've been an active manager for over 30 years, and I think that there's room for both. They complement each other and fit into portfolios really well. For the younger investor, for my son, he should be in indexing. He doesn't need to worry about active management. He doesn't need to worry if the market goes down 20 or 30%. He doesn't have any money. Keep putting it in. Having it diversified, you don't want it all high risk. Don't put it all in Bitcoin. And he might, but that wouldn't be my advice. But you have the power of time. And for people that have lots of money, I think that active management takes a much larger role because it gives us the ability to reduce some of the risk profile when things get choppy. And you can simply compare that for when markets are down a lot. Now, the counter argument is that markets have enjoyed good returns more times than they've enjoyed atrocious and awful returns. Problem is, you can't always predict black swan events. So for me, it's about having a larger allocation to active management. I think the more assets you have, and perhaps you can be a beneficiary of more passive, lower cost investments when you have little and are building your net worth and your wealth throughout the course of your life. Not a question of one being better than the other. It's easy to be a passive investor when interest rates are at zero. They were for a really long time. It's not a criticism against them. It's just that if we have an interest rate environment that isn't zero, and that's where we are now, does give active managers, at least good ones, a little bit more of a fighting chance.
One other question about the active management. Have you, like, are you seeing AI and machine learning helping in those types of situations over the next decade or so?
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure at some point, I've seen The Matrix and The Terminator. I see AI, like,
Got it.
Eliminating the human race. But,
got it.
We because of the options that we bring into our portfolio,
sure.
There's a lot of nuance and I think art that goes into it that eventually I think the computer might be able to learn. But we're not there yet. I do use it quite a bit for time efficiency.
Sure.
So I don't use it in any stock picking. I don't use it in any portfolio analysis, but I use it a great deal in terms of summary. Large language models are good at summarizing data.
Sure.
Sure, they're great at a lot of things, but for our practice in particular, I'll give you just one example because I know we're up against it on a time constraint. But when a company does an earnings call every quarter, you can sit there for 30 to 45 or an hour of your time and listen to the earnings call. Now we have an AI system that listens to that earnings call, takes a full transcript, and then summarizes the transcript. And we still have the complete transcript to refer to. But now, in 5 to 10 minutes, I can digest all of the information that I would have had to have sat through for 45 minutes, including Q&A. So it does. So there is a wonderful application for artificial intelligence
for
in
sure.
our world from a time standpoint. And that's a very specific way in which we use it.
Awesome.
Wow. Kevin, I know you are up against the clock here, and so we don't want to hold you up. We could go on and on with you.
Nobody wants to listen to us talk for 45 minutes. That's the problem with Corey's podcast. I have to turn it off after the third hour.
Well, we really appreciate you jumping on and spending some time with us today and the insights you provided for not only us, but our listeners here. We're going to wrap. That's going to be the end of our episode today. We appreciate everyone for jumping on, and we look forward to hearing you next time on the next episode of the Bull Time Investor. Thanks, everyone.
Look forward to joining you guys again. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
The opinions voiced in this show are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. Securities and advisory services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor. Member FINRA/SIPC.